Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where
prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Fruit Loops, episode 166. Buiti binafi, bienvenidos, bitches, and thank you so much for listening.
Yeah.
Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that we don't hear or know much about. Contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are straight cis white dudes. No, there are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and Fruit Loops is a podcast all about them. We will take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers and true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that the media and entertainment commonly leave out because the news is racist, allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy, a Black Latinx woman. And I'm Beth, and I just happen to be white.
She's an accomplice, y'all. It's not her fault.
We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists. Just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to FruitloopsPod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at
602-935-6294.
And we may feature it on a future episode.
Also, our website is FruitloopsPod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all our social media. The footnotes for each episode can be found on our website. Plus, check it out for the different ways that you can support the show, become a Patreon, and you can also support our show by supporting our sponsors.
Yeah.
So, who are we talking about today, Beth?
Today we're talking about David Thabo Simelane, a serial killer from Eswatini, Africa, who was sentenced to death for the murder of 28 women and children, but is suspected of murdering at least 45 people.
This was a fascinating case to research.
Yeah.
And first of all, Eswatini, Africa, I have a giant map of Africa in my home, and I had never seen or noticed the country.
Yeah,
or heard of it. And it's right there in front of our eyes.
Yep.
Anyway, so before we get into it, how you doing?
I'm all right. You know, just maintaining.
Yes.
How are you doing?
Okay. Well, I've missed you. Everything is good. No complaints. I'm healthy. I have what I need. School has started.
Oh, wow.
And we're just back in the groove.
Right on. Like,
exciting stuff.
Yeah.
And somebody got fired at work today.
Oh no.
It was one of those weird things where they did an emergency meeting and then they said this person no longer works here, and then all the it was wild.
Yeah.
Now apparently what happened is this person said that the company we work for sucks, like out loud in public to like, and then like managers, VIP, CEO, people, in front of everybody.
Wow.
And you can't do that with your job. And so it's just
not a good idea. Yeah.
Not a good idea. So let that be a lesson to us all. That do not bite the hand that feeds us, shall we? Amen. Now let's get into some listener letters.
All right.
Where are you? There you go.
Well, hello, angels.
Oh, yes. All right. What in the world is in that bag, Beth?
Well, we got a letter from Linda, who responded to Wendy, who had asked, "What's so good about Ohio?"
Oh, yeah. Linda, thank you for your email.
Yeah, Linda's from Dayton, and she said it's a good place to be from, but also a good place to leave.
Hello. Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah. We also got a review calling us racist against white people.
Uh-oh, so how does that work when white people have all the power?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a thing, but it's inconsequential and it's not what we're doing.
Right.
So I have to say again that talking about racism is not racist.
No, it is not.
Plus, you know, I'm white and so is Minnie and so is your husband. So
Right.
Yeah, no, a lot of white people around here. A lot of snow around you.
Lots of snow. And I love people, human beings, and I love people who can treat me as such.
Right.
And I think that, you know, more importantly, if we don't talk about the problem, like racism, then we can't fix it.
Right. I mean, you can't just like sweep it under the rug.
Absolutely. And I am not racist. I'm anti-racist, but I hate white supremacy and I hate patriarchy and I will not apologize for those
things. No, you don't have to.
Right. And those things are problems that we have in our society. Yeah. Again, white supremacy, patriarchy, poverty, crime, just to name a few of the things that we're dealing with as citizens in this world. And I can understand that if you don't experience racism or discrimination daily or care to listen or understand someone you care about who experiences, try to empathize that new things, these new conversations can make you uncomfortable and seem like attacks, but
they're not. No,
they're not. So just, you know, the discomfort might come. We all experience, I mean, I experience it as a woman, as a person of color, that discomfort all the time. So if you're new to this, just ride with it and try to learn from it.
Yeah.
Also, we have no new Patreons this week.
Okay.
But that's okay.
Yeah.
For those of y'all who are on Patreon, we look forward to our video club party and our Q&A coming up. What's the streaming thing we're watching? The worst man in America? The most hated man in America.
The most hated man on the internet.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
And then before we forget, I wanted to say thank you, Lindsay B, for your glorious message. Hello. And also Linda, as we said, she said there's good things about Ohio. I just don't remember everything she said. But thank you so much, everybody, for rocking with us.
Oh, Olive Garden.
Oh, yeah. The Olive Garden was, I guess, Italian or ethnic representation, which is so funny. So shout out to everybody listening in Ohio.
Yeah,
we're going to take a quick break and we're going to get into the story when we come back.
"3 AM, the comedy horror podcast that holds weekly gatherings around the campfire. Let me tell you what you're going to get. You're going to hear stories about demonic possessions, prison stabbings, skinwalkers, glitches in the matrix, cult leaders, missing 411, night marchers, Operation Paperclip, Mesopotamian devil worship, and so many monsters it'll give Kanye West a runaway for his money. Pop and meme culture also aren't off topic. A camp where laughs and scares are constantly competing for first place. We're just a group of friends, trying to bust each other's balls, find the best stories, and expand the circle in the process. 3 AM, the comedy horror podcast, not for the faint or fragile of heart. Let's go.
Something is creeping, don't follow it down.
Let me introduce you to Barry Clue, an authorised financial advisor from New Zealand and a very special kind of stain on humanity.
He was a very knowledgeable young guy.
He was a registered financial advisor.
Type of guy that was bending over backwards to help you.
Now, you could be forgiven for thinking that Barry sounds like a great guy, and you'd be right. Well, right up until the point when you're wrong.
It was all fictitious.
You stole from my son, who has a disability.
Chris never knew. He died believing that we're all taken care of.
A psychopath is somebody who lacks empathy, acts impulsively. I think there's a strong case that Barry might be all of those things, actually.
To find out how Barry Clue stole over $15 million from 81 victims, subscribe to Clueless, The Long Con. That's Clueless, spelt K-L-O-O-G-H-L-E-S-S.
Right. We're back. Now remind us, Beth, who is our subject today?
Our subject today is David Thabo Simelane, a serial killer from Eswatini who is convicted of killing 28 women and children between 1999 and 2001.
All right, so let's get into some stats, shall we? So David Thabo, uppercut, hook. Was there kicks in Thabo?
I have no idea.
You never did it?
No. Oh,
what?
Nope.
You never did the videos. Oh,
nope.
My God. Okay,
nope.
Well, totally unrelated. But anyway, David Thabo Simelane, a.k.a. David Albert Mlanga, a.k.a. Pepisa Yende, he was convicted of murdering 28 women and children, but he probably murdered over 35 and possibly as many as 45, maybe even more. So we just want to say rest in power to all the victims. We didn't get all of their names, but we just wanted to lift them up, and also thoughts and prayers to the loved ones and communities left in the wake of these heinous crimes. So now we're going to get into the setting. Take us there, Beth.
Well, Eswatini, officially the Kingdom of Eswatini, and formerly the Kingdom of Swaziland, is a landlocked country in southern Africa. It's bordered by Mozambique to its northeast and South Africa to its north, west, south, and southeast. The capital and largest city is Mbabane.
Yeah, it's at the southern tip of Africa, and South Africa is like the country is giving it a hug. It
Aww.
Is what it
How
looks
cute.
Like to me. Yeah. Except South Africa is I don't know. It's got some, you know, explaining to do. But Eswatini is one of the smallest countries in Africa, a little smaller than New Jersey. However, the climate and topography are diverse. There are four well-defined physiographic regions, the high veld. Is it veld or level?
Veld.
My eyes are playing tricks on me. Let me clean my glasses.
I think it's Dutch. It comes from Dutch.
Oh,
you know?
Those other colonizers that we
don't talk about so much.
We don't talk about so much. Maybe it's the wooden shoes. I don't know. So the high veld, the middle veld, the low veld, and the Lubombo escarpment. We should mention that these names of places and names of people are not in our native language, and we apologize in advance for butchering any of the pronunciations.
Yeah.
We mean no disrespect.
And we're trying.
Yes, we are trying.
The climate in Eswatini is generally subtropical, but subject to steep temperature and precipitation gradients because of a fall in altitude of about 4,000 feet over a distance of about 50 miles. Isn't that
Whoa.
Wild?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Quite a drop.
And during the rainy summer season in the western high veld, the mountains turn a tropical green. Dotting the landscape are enormous boulders piled high enough in some areas that you can go caving underneath.
Whoa.
Yeah. In between are grasslands and forest.
It sounds really beautiful.
It does. It really does.
Archaeologists have found human remains in eastern Swaziland that have been dated back 110,000 years. The earliest stone tools found on ancient river terraces date back more than 250,000 years.
Wow.
And they try to tell black kids in school that we don't have no history. Hello? So the ancestors of the Swazi came down from East Central Africa hundreds of years ago, along with the ancestors of the Zulu and Xhosa peoples.
Swaziland was originally part of Mozambique, and the Swazi moved into the Mozambique area prior to the 16th century. About 1820, facing aggression from their southern neighbors, they moved northward to establish a safer heartland in what is now called Central Eswatini.
So the southern neighbors would be the South Africans.
The Zulu.
Oh, the Zulu. Okay.
Yeah.
So King Mswati II ruled from 1840 to 1868, and the people living there became known as Baka Mswati, or the people of Mswati. During the 1800s, European settlers, traders, missionaries, and hunters moved into the area with the intention of making it their home.
Huh.
But y'all, people already live there. What are you talking about?
I think I'm going to move in. Can you move your stuff? I want to put my bed here.
Excuse me. This is mine.
Oh my God. The audacity, the caucasity of it all.
Yeah. Oh, man. Europeans called the people living there the easier to pronounce Swazi and their territory Swaziland. In 1877, the British annexed the kingdom. In 1881, the British government signed a convention recognizing Swazi independence. This independence was largely on paper, however, and in 1894, Swaziland became a protectorate of the South African Republic, which was under British control following the Second Anglo-Boer War.
Now, I started to look up the word protectorate, but I didn't finish copying and pasting it into my Google search bar. That means territory, right?
I think so. Let me check. Okay, protectorate. A state that is controlled and protected by another. Yeah, it sounds pretty much like a colony.
Sounds awful imperialist to me.
Yes, it sounds very similar to a colony.
Yes. So the arrangement continued until 1906 when the kingdom became a high commission territory under the rulership of a British commissioner. Swazis were made to live in native areas that were situated like a patchwork quilt across the Swaziland map. And by the way, all this is already so problematic.
Yeah.
They're saying, we're going to call you Swazis just because it's easier. Because, we don't want to try. We're also going to just move in. Also, we're going to just on paper.
We're going to pretend that you have independence.
Pseudo-sovereignty. Yeah.
But you don't really. And then.
And then we're going to put you in these areas.
Yeah.
For you guys that we don't want, though. But you'll love it.
You're going to love it.
Yeah. This place has everything. No, sir, it doesn't. And also, I was going to say, around this decade, the 1900 and the 1870s and 80s and 90s, the colonizers were real shooketh after Haiti won their independence and fought hard for it. And so there was sort of this effort, and I haven't read this anywhere, but this is my impression from learning the history, is that the colonizers were shook and nervous and did all they could to sort of
box
them in, like sort of trap them before they could get
do
out,
anything.
Before they could, get any ideas, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. So for the next 66 years, Swaziland remained under British control. Many Swazi men left their homes to raise money as mine workers to buy parts of their land back. By 1963, limited self-government was allowed. In 1967, Swaziland became a kingdom under a new constitution. And on September 6, 1968, Swaziland was granted complete independence.
Finally, we wouldn't have any of these problems if the colonizers hadn't come here in the first place. But anyway, it was still a member of the Commonwealth of Nations, and the King Sobhuza II had come into power in 1921, became the head of state. The country was administered by a cabinet and a prime minister selected by parliament. Oh, that's fair.
But just 5 years into his reign, Sobhuza II repealed the constitution designed by the British and restored the traditional system of government in which all effective power remains in the royal capital. A system of local government known as the Tinkhundla operates at the grassroots. Sobhuza's concession to modern government was to retain the cabinet system with a prime minister and other ministers, but all were chosen by the king.
Under his rule, Swaziland enjoyed a remarkable degree of political stability and economic progress. Emphasis was placed on education, which had been neglected in colonial times, on health, and on other human resource developments.
King Sobhuza's death on August 21st, 1982, was followed by a power struggle within the royal family, which was not finally resolved until 1986, when his son, Prince Makosetu, 18 at the time, was installed as King Mswati III.
His rule had been characterized as autocratic, with widespread corruption and excess, and demands for democratic reform have followed his reign throughout the years. In 2005, King Mswati III acceded to popular demands for a new constitution, but he still maintained absolute power.
According to the Constitution, King Maswari III is not bound to any law, and he reportedly takes great advantage of it.
Whoa!
The king chooses his country's prime minister and cabinet and possesses the power to dissolve parliament. The Eswatini authorities have used the Suppression of Terrorism Act of 2008 and the Sedition and Subversive Activities Act of 1938 to suppress free speech and stifle criticism of the monarch.
Ooh.
Yeah.
No.
Not so good.
Not so good. So his family holds a stake in numerous business ventures, including at least 25% cut of mining deals in the country. Much of that wealth goes towards supporting his large family of 15 wives and more than 30 children.
In April 2018, I believe it was on the anniversary of 50 years of independence, King Maswari III announced that he was changing the official name of the country from the Kingdom of Swaziland to the Kingdom of Eswatini. And we may use Swaziland and Eswatini interchangeably during this episode because it was still called Swaziland when these crimes occurred.
All right. So Eswatini is the only remaining absolute monarchy in Africa. It has been repeatedly criticized for violation of human rights and the wealth of the royal family against a background of extreme poverty, which affects the majority of the population.
King Maswari III has a lavish lifestyle of luxury cars and palaces, and his children flaunt their opulent birthday parties on social media. Meanwhile, about 6 out of 10 of Eswatini citizens live in poverty. Many are on the brink of starvation and have to cross into South Africa to find work.
I think that's a testament of like humanity and the desire for wealth and power that is just so hard. I mean, once you get it, it's like you're not going to do anything to let it go, right? And that seems like what King Maswati is up
to. Yeah, I understand it, but I don't get it, you know?
I mean, that's never going to happen to me anyway, but it sounds interesting.
Want, ever.
What? Okay, no. Speak for yourself.
No, yeah, I am. I am speaking for myself. It's not on my list of to-do things. No.
You don't want to be the boss of everything
nope.
and have all the things?
Nope, don't.
Okay, I guess I don't either.
Don't care.
Yeah, that seems like a lot. You know what? I'm good. I'm going to stick to podcasting.
Seems too stressful to me.
Yeah. So in September, and it reminds me of our guy Nine, who just got raided by the FBI.
The FBI. But her emails.
Oh my God. Oh man, what a story. What a saga.
Yeah.
I'm just eating my popcorn.
I can't wait to read about it in 30 years.
I wonder what the history books are going to say.
Oh, it's going to be so scathing.
Is it going to be whitewashed? You know, kind of like how all the other bad things in our nation's history are.
I don't know.
There's only a little paragraph for slavery and then Martin Luther King happens and then Obama and then progress.
Yeah, progress. Yeah. I don't know. I guess we'll see. I just remember watching a series about the presidents of the United States and learning about all the presidents and like some of the stories were pretty bad.
So it's documented pretty well.
Yeah.
Everything that's happened. So
yeah,
if it was whitewashed, it would be strange and
it
clearly
would be
intentional.
Very strange. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, back to the story.
Sorry. side note, tangent. In September 2019, the Eswatini Registrar of Companies refused to register Eswatini Sexual and Gender Minorities, ESGM, as a company. ESGM is a human rights community-based advocacy organization which aims to advance the protection of human rights of LGBTQ persons.
The Eswatini Registrar of Companies stated that, quote, ESGM's objectives were unlawful because same-sex sexual acts are illegal in the country, unquote. ESGM argued that the registrar was wrong to assume that ESGM's purpose was illegal when there was no evidence of this. I mean, they're not having sex, right?
Right. This is about human rights, not about fucking. So maybe they didn't read the memo right. So ESGM's mission is to protect and advance the interests of LGBTQ persons through education and advocacy. And Eswatini's laws do not make it a crime to be lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. On October 20th, 2020, the High Court heard a challenge by ESGM. On April 29th, 2022, the Eswatini High Court upheld the decision to refuse registration of ESGM.
Anger against the king has been building for years in the country, and in 2021, Eswatini was rocked by waves of pro-democracy protests. Demonstrations first erupted in May following the death of a 25-year-old law student, reportedly at the hands of police. Protests against Eswatini's monarchy system broke out on June 29, 2021, led by young people, particularly high school and university students, in response to the country's lack of development and opportunities.
Shout out to those people for rising up. The authorities responded by banning protests, and the Eswatini Communications Commission allegedly ordered network providers to shut down the internet to prevent protesters from mobilizing online. They deployed police and soldiers who shot protesters indiscriminately with live ammunition. And by the way, we covered this on... I remember this on our on an extra episode.
Oh, so we have heard of Eswatini.
Yeah, we have heard of Eswatini.
I just remember this. And forgot about
it.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of shit happened in 2020 and 2021.
Oh my God.
Hard to remember everything that happened.
Forgive us. Yeah. Our brains are... Yeah. Oh, there's only so much that could fit in there. Yeah.
So 8 people died in clashes with security forces, initiating protests over the following months that have since become sporadic. According to authorities, a total of 37 people died in the prolonged protests, while Human Rights Watch puts the total at 46. However, a statement issued by the Eswatini Solidarity Fund puts the death toll closer to 80, with around 300 injured and almost 1,000 arrested.
Wow. At the time, Eswatini ranked 141 out of 180 countries in the Reporters Without Borders World Press Index on media freedom, based partially on constraints journalists face under the absolute monarchy and because courts are not permitted to prosecute crimes and abuses against representatives of the monarchy. What?
Yeah. Although civil unrest does still occur sporadically, Eswatini is considered a safe country to visit. In fact, one of the safest countries in the region. Hospitality is a cornerstone of Swazi culture, and Eswatini is known for its low crime rate and the friendliness and kindness of its locals. Although petty crime like theft and pickpocketing is still a problem.
Yeah, but those are crimes of survival and struggle, which have to do with inequality. So
yes, exactly.
A little foreshadowing. Anyway, we will get into the early life of Similani. So David Tabo, I won't do it. Similani was born in 1956 in Swaziland, now Eswatini. He was born Malanga, his father's surname, but was raised from infancy on his aunt's Similani homestead, located in a remote part of the country, far from a paved road. In exchange for herding the family cattle and helping with the harvest, the Similanis paid his school fees.
He was described by his aunt as a very brilliant child who started school later than most of his peers, but soon surpassed them. By the time he was in high school, however, David had lost interest in school. Although his uncle was still willing to pay his school fees, David dropped out in the 10th grade.
After that, his aunt says he was, quote, all over the place, unquote. He would spend nights in the forest, eat from other people's fields, and come back to the homestead and sleep in the kraal, an enclosure for animals.
I think it must be where the word corral comes from.
Oh,
maybe. I don't know.
Look it. Yeah. English stole another word.
As we do.
Yes.
He first got into trouble with the law in 1976 at the age of 19 when he stabbed his girlfriend.
Huh?
Yeah. She didn't die. And he served 15 months in prison. Between 1976 and 1993, he was convicted of 8 different offenses, ranging from robbery to rape.
He was convicted of indecent assault, robbery, and housebreaking in the late 70s and early 80s. He once went to jail for threatening to stab a woman with a knife in order to steal a handbag containing the equivalent of $2.
In 1991, he was arrested and charged with robbery and rape. On June 23, 1993, he was convicted, although he professed innocence. He was sentenced to 6 years and released sometime in 1999.
Hi, Hi, I'm Sean McCabe.
And I'm Carrie McCabe.
We are, well, married, obviously, but we're also obsessed with the darker side of things.
True crime stories, alien abductions, poltergeists. If it leaves you scratching your head and keeping those lights on at night, we want to hear about it.
That's why we host the podcast, Ain't It Scary, with Sean and Carrie.
Every week, we bring our listeners a true story guaranteed to send chills down your spine. From history's most brutal serial killers to the mystery of spontaneous human combustion.
Yep, lots of these stories leave unanswered questions behind, and you'll get to poke through the rubble of the evidence with a hardened skeptic and...
someone whose mind is more open to fun.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
You can find Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie wherever you get your podcasts. And on social media at Ain't It Scary. Come play with us.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes, I've traced heroic acts of bravery, and I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.
All right, now it's time to hop on into the timeline. So after he was released, Similani found a place to live for about $7 a month. It was a single room with one light bulb and no electrical outlets or running water.
Between 1999 and 2001, women in Swaziland began disappearing. In some instances, children who accompanied their mothers also went missing along with them. In each instance, the missing women were reported to have left their homes in order to take up employment offered to them, never to return.
At the time, unemployment in Swaziland stood at nearly 30%. So men from Swaziland often left to South Africa to work in mines. The women and children would be left at the homesteads, which sometimes included several buildings with housing for different wives and older relatives, as well as land for agriculture and animals. The women were often desperate to find more immediate income.
Most of the missing women were from rural areas. Many had dropped out of school, were poor and uneducated, and were living off the food that they grew or donations. They lived without electricity or running water.
In 2016, Nolanla Vilakati, a professor at the University of Swaziland, said, quote, "In this situation of socioeconomic vulnerability, all hope is pinned on this one female member of the family. What becomes important is finding the job, and all issues of personal safety just fade into insignificance," unquote.
In December 1999, Nelsiwe Nzinisa, 25, of Madlenya, vanished. Sifowe Goodness Gininza, 17, of Feni, disappeared in September of 2000. Sizakeli Letsiwe Magagula, 20, of Amalangeni, disappeared in 2001.
In January 2001, 15-year-old Sibongile Dlamini was with her older sister, Vosho, at a bus station when Similani introduced himself to them. He displayed an obvious interest in Vosho. Over the next 3 months, he became a regular visitor at the Dlamini homestead in the St. Phillips area as he courted Vosho and got to know the family.
Sibongile remembered him as a quiet man who always seemed to have money, though she never knew where it came from. A friend of the Dlamini family later said that Similane always brought gifts to the family. Quote, "He would bring these things, these groceries, and we were convinced that where they came from, there was life," unquote.
He claimed to be a recruiter looking for female workers. Vosho knew that her sister, Tuana, badly needed a job. She had recently left her marital homestead and was caring for four children on her own. Tuana was the first to leave with Similani to start a job as a maid in Ezulwini, a valley just outside Mbane.
About a month later, he offered employment to another sister, Tandy, who traveled with her 18-month-old child, Kwanda. Another month later, she hadn't returned, and the family became worried. They had no phone, and Sibongile said, quote, "Each time we suggested we go and see Tandy's place, he would say that Tandy was busy. He would perpetually postpone the visit," unquote.
Similane brought a letter to the family, supposedly from Tandy, in which was written in type, quote, "It is a long time not coming to see you, but there is nothing I can do because at present I am alone at work. My partner is on leave until April 8th. Anyway, I'm okay here. Nothing wrong so far," unquote.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing yet. Everything is awesome. So in the letter, she asked for her sister Vosho to meet her. And soon after Vosho left with Similane, Tuana, Tandy, Vosho, and the little Kwanda were never seen alive again.
On February 20th, 2001, Rose Nunn and her 13-month-old baby, Nathando Kumalo, left home for the social welfare offices. They did not come home as expected that afternoon, and her live-in boyfriend, Umbangene Mlotsa, reported their disappearance to their parents, who lived next door to their home in Manzini. The police were contacted, but nothing came of it.
I wonder what the police broke up that protest that we knew about. So maybe they're just as trash there as they are here.
Yeah, possibly.
In mid-March of 2001, 26-year-old Samantha Kagasi Ngobesi disappeared. She had planned to travel to Mbane, the capital of Swaziland, to apply for a job at the High Court. Samantha had a law degree from the University of Swaziland and was hoping to use it.
But at the bus stop in Manzini, she met a man who promised her a different job, and she never made it to Mbane. The man told her that he could get her a position at a chemical company. The job would pay 4,000 MLJeni per month, which is Eswatini currency, and it was equivalent to a little less than $500, which was a very good salary in Swaziland.
Oh, yeah. And then what is this, in the early 2000s?
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Also, this bus stop.
That seems to be his
MO.
Yeah.
Excited about this opportunity, she ran home to change. Mabel Kagasi, Samantha's mother, described how hopeful her daughter had been when she came home. Samantha left again to meet this man and never returned.
Around the same time, a man named Simon Motza reported that his wife Fikile, a 37-year-old preschool teacher, and his one-year-old daughter, Lindo Kule, were missing. Simon had last seen his wife and daughter on the night of March 10th.
The couple did not live together during the work week, and she had left Simon late to head back to the home of her in-laws. Simon was concerned because Fikile and Lindo Kule would have to walk in the dark as there were few streetlights in Swaziland.
Motza found out that his wife never arrived at her in-law's house, nor did she show up for her teaching job. He contacted Fikile's family, but they hadn't seen her either. He reported her missing to the police in Matsapa.
On April 2nd, 2001, at Eagle's Nest Farm in Malkerns, a one-market town 15 miles from the city of Mankayane, a worker came upon the decomposing bodies of two women and a baby girl. The bodies had been in the bush about 3 weeks, and one of the child's legs was missing.
Simon Motza was later able to identify two of these bodies as his wife and child. Fikile's hands had been tied behind her back, and she had deep cut wounds on her head and neck. He recognized little Lindo Kule by her clothes. The third body was not positively identified.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah.
A few days later, a skull was found in a plastic KFC bag in the same area. On April 6, 2001, a herd boy discovered a human skeleton on a forest in Malkerns. The police went there and found remains which consisted of a human skull, ribs, and other bones scattered all over the scene.
Around the same time, police received another report from the Eagle's Nest farm workers that they had discovered more human skeletons. On April 10th, six skeletons and a decomposing body were also found, all within a short distance. Police began warning people to stay in their homes at night.
Wow. So this is a lot.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of decomposing
bodies. Skeletons everywhere.
And skeletons everywhere. And I'm also thinking about the climate, which we described earlier. Like, it was probably
subtropical,
warm, wet, all those things which
would cause a body to decompose faster. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Superintendent Jomo Mavuso and Senior Superintendent Keto Twaki Ngamandla were assigned to head the investigation. Their cell phone numbers were printed in the newspaper, and they led a team of nine other officers.
That's wild that they printed their cell phone numbers in the newspaper.
I know, but yeah. I mean, that's a go-getter of a detective if I ever did see one.
Yeah, they're going to be working that hard for sure.
Yeah, Yeah.
On April 12, 2001, they brought more than 200 police officers and soldiers to comb the Eagle's Nest area. An additional 13 sets of remains were discovered.
Holy shit. Yeah,
some just loose bones, but several more recent victims with flesh still remaining.
Jesus. Wow. Híjole, that is a lot.
Yeah.
The bodies of four babies were among the dead. Many of the women had their hands tied, were naked, and appeared to have been sexually assaulted. About half of the women had been decapitated. Relatives of missing women soon flocked to the area to see if their loved ones were among the victims. So now we're going to get into the investigation and the arrest. Hit it, Beth. Uppercut. Uppercut. Hook. Hook. Kick. Kick. Tybo.
So Swaziland, or Eswatini, is approximately 90% Christian, and religious people throughout the country were calling for prayer to find the killer. King Mswati III's mother suspected demon activity and urged her subjects to pray for salvation, saying, quote, "The demons have spread everywhere, and they can only be subdued by prayer," unquote.
Oh, well, you know, there's something that we say in the Black community. It's called, it's push. Pray until something happens. And that seems to be what she is encouraging.
It sounds like it.
The demon activity is a new one, though, as far as crime theories.
Yes, that is new.
Interesting
take.
Yes, interesting take. So that's an option, but the League of Churches blamed the movement for the restoration of the Ten Commandments of God. And the story we covered in episode 51 and 52 about Sister Credonia Merwinde and her cult that ended up murdering over 700 people.
Yep.
That's right. Women groups blamed a traditional and sexist culture. Another valid take.
Valid theory. Yeah. Based on the location of the bodies and the last places the missing women had been seen, the police traced the routes of the victims. Most of them were last seen in or known to have been traveling to Malkerns or Manzini, towns where job seekers might go. Police also attempted to track down those who had last been seen with the victims, many of whom had last been seen with a man who had promised them work.
All right, we're getting somewhere. So South African police officers were brought in just because white ice isn't colder, y'all. Anyway, including specialists in forensics, investigative psychology, and profiling. Besides assisting with the investigation, South African police were meant to help identify the bodies using DNA profiling and facial reconstruction, expertise that was not available in Swaziland. All right, I'll allow it.
Wait till you get to the next part of the story.
Okay.
All right. The police eventually narrowed down their search to a specific person whose description was widely circulated. The man was then recognized at a supermarket by the husband of a missing woman, and the police apprehended him. It was David Simulani.
Got him. So Simulani was arrested in Langano, the fourth largest town in Eswatini, on April 25th, 2001. He was brought to the local police station. Police said that Simulani confessed to the crimes then and there without coercion. Simulani said he would lure the women to the forest with job prospects, then tied his victims and sexually assaulted them, stabbing and strangling them with his bare hands if they resisted too much. Almost like he was just describing what he ate for lunch that day.
Yeah, no biggie.
Did you see the video of him?
I didn't. Was he speaking in English?
No, it was was subtitled. But his demeanor is just like that. Just
very calm.
This is what I did. You can ask me questions. But I'm just going to sit here, legs crossed, relaxing maxing in the chair.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really something.
So he also beheaded many of them before or after death. Simulani often stole his victims' money and valuables. Among his victims were several pregnant women. His motive, he said, was revenge against women due to the quote-unquote false rape charge from 1991, for which he served time.
Oh boy. So on May 8th, 2001, Simulani made a second confession to the magistrate, Charles Masango. The only other person present was the magistrate's interpreter.
interpreter. Semolani was advised by the magistrate that he was not obliged to say anything, but that whatever he said would be recorded and might be used as evidence at his trial.
Though the common language of Eswatini is Siswati, the confessions were written by the translator in English, the language used for police and court records. The translator wrote the confession, which was 10 pages long, and then reread it to Semolani, who agreed that it was accurate and correct. In this written confession, he again claimed that he had killed the women out of revenge for having been wrongfully convicted of rape.
Oh, boy. Yeah. That June, the police took Semolani out of his holding cell so he could lead them to more bodies to add to those found in Malkern's. Much of the search was videotaped, including when he was read his rights and told that what he showed them could be used against him in court.
The video follows Semolani as he leads officers to skeletons in heavily forested areas, very difficult to access. The bodies were found in four distinct areas: Munkanyani, Malkern's, Masajeni, and Sidvakadvo. These areas are as little as 15 miles apart and as much as 50.
Wow. So he was busy.
All over the place. Yeah.
All like his auntie
like
said.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Shout out to the aunties.
She knew.
Yes. Okay. So Semolani led police to the top of a remote mountain to retrieve some of the final bodies. The police walked through thick, pathless bush and climbed large boulders to get there. Eventually, 45 bodies were found, but because of advanced decay, Semolani was only charged with 35 murders.
Although Semolani repeatedly claimed in his confession that he killed the women out of revenge, police suspected something else. Belief in healers and in moody and traditional medicine is widespread in Eswatini.
Yeah, that was another thing I gleaned from the video with him and interrogators, is they were like, no way, you climb all these mountains, went through all these forests and bush all by yourself? What?
Yeah.
And he was just like, no, it was me. Just chilling. It was me. So these traditional healers are for many Swazis the first line of defense against hard times, whether caused by illness, romance, or poverty. They're called upon to harness the power of traditional medicine called muti and heal wounds both physical and spiritual. In 2000, there were as many as 8,000 traditional healers in Swaziland versus 150 medical doctors.
The most extreme version of muti involves ritual murder,
huh?
Also known as moody murder or medicine murder, in which a human being is killed and his or her body parts made into a concoction or a charm. When HIV struck Swaziland in the 2000s, the number of young people dying of AIDS reached epic proportions, and those who had the means would seek out the most potent protection they could find, and this was often muti.
And HIV hit Swaziland particularly hard in the 2000s.
Yeah.
It hit South Africa and Swaziland for some reason more than the rest of the continent. So I thought that was interesting. If you Google the AIDS crisis,
Or
the AIDS epidemic, and look at a map of Africa.
And a lot of them believed that it was demons, or they didn't really believe that it was a virus.
Yeah.
And so they were looking for spiritual ways to stave off the illness. Mm-hmm. And one of the things was moody.
Right. Another thing that was circulated to rid yourself of the virus or protect yourself was to continue having sex with women. And that ended up spreading the disease more.
Wow.
And there was, condoms weren't...
not a thing, really?
Not a thing that men in the area were particularly fond of. And so the disease just became more widespread. So it's kind of a perfect storm of when you look at the theories, a perfect storm of, it could have been a demon. Maybe it was a spiritual thing. So it makes sense in my mind, but I'm not explaining it very well. So I'm going to shut up. Anyway, the belief in muti is not relegated to the rural poor and uneducated. In fact, a former advisor to the king was quoted in WikiLeaks. as saying that King Mswati III believes in traditional healing and, quote, attempts to use muti to attack the king are taken seriously, unquote.
Hmm.
Noted.
Don't do that.
I won't.
So police suspected that Semolani was working with someone else or more than one other person and killing for body parts to be sold and used for muti. Several of the skeletons were missing bones when they were found. Similani did not have a job, yet he had money. The bodies were found in remote areas that were difficult to get to, yet he was somehow able to get there and get his victims there. But when confronted, David denied that he had any partners in these crimes.
But on June 12, 2001, during a videotaping 7 weeks after his arrest, Similani gave up three additional names. All names were famous men in Swaziland. Peace Mufana Boy Motsa, a wealthy businessman, Majehebutimba Dlamini, a member of parliament, and a third man, a former member of parliament. These were the people, he said, who hired him to kill.
Similani claimed that he could get 3,000 imogeni, about $370 US a month. He would also get two combis, communal taxis, and a Sprinter minibus worth a total of 300,000 imogeni, worth about $37,000 in US.
Whoa.
Which is an enormous amount of money in Swaziland. Yeah.
Woo.
He claimed that Boy Motsa and his partners, quote, are the ones who got me into this line of work, unquote.
But the conspiracy theory in me, if you buy that these dudes were involved and you buy the fact that these wealthy businessmen were like trying to stay wealthy or keep disease away or do all the things that people seek healing for,
right,
that it makes sense that they might have pursued Mutu murder. I don't know. It's too early for my takes. I'm sorry. So he further claimed that in order to ensure that nobody betrayed the syndicate, it was agreed that should anyone get arrested, that person should never expose the others. Those who had not been caught would then finance the legal defense of the one who was arrested.
Similani also claimed that his employers had personally participated in seven murders and that they had used a Nissan one-ton pickup truck belonging to one of the partners to transport the victims to secluded places.
But all three men he named had been prominently featured in the newspapers that same month, so it's possible that he simply picked them because they were fresh in his mind. Boy Motsa had publicly offered to pay for the coffins of Similani's victims. This gesture prompted rumors that he was involved with the killings and could have given Similani the idea of naming him as an accomplice.
Police have claimed that they thoroughly investigated these men and found their connection to be a figment of David's imagination. They eventually concluded that he was working alone with a motive of revenge for the rape conviction.
Once all the bodies were recovered, the next step was figuring out who the victims were. The written confession included a numbered list of the victims, but it had two number sevens, and several of the women Similani said he had killed were either unnamed or identified only by their surname.
Although Similani was eventually held on 35 counts of murder, 4 years into his trial, the number of counts was reduced to 34 when it was discovered that two of the victims named were the same person.
Damn it. Since most of the bodies were decomposed, the police turned to using the victims' clothing as proof of identity. Friends and family of all the women that Similani admitted to killing were brought in to match pieces of clothing to those that belonged to their sisters, daughters, and wives. Some of the clothing had been found near the bodies, and some had been found in the possession of one of Similani's girlfriends.
With the help of the Department of Anatomy at the University of Pretoria in South Africa, reports on at least some of the skeletal remains were made, but they only proved the sex and the likely age range and race of the bodies found. Even after years of waiting, DNA evidence never came through. Not a single body could be positively identified by experts post-mortem, nor could the cause of death be confirmed.
Oh my gosh, yeah. DNA didn't come through?
No, well, they didn't do it.
Okay. I was going to say, it didn't. DNA didn't work?
No, they just didn't test it. Yeah.
Oh, wow. And that's really disappointing.
Yeah.
That's, oh my gosh, it seems so simple, but I imagine the resources perhaps just were not there.
Probably, yeah.
So over the years between his arrest and the trial, it was reported that Similani went on a hunger strike, overdosed on some unspecified substance, had a stroke, beat his head against the wall, and tried to hang himself with a shirt.
In October of 2004, he was taken to Mbabane Government Hospital, where he was unconscious for 5 days in the ICU.
Whoa.
Both in 2001 and 2004, he was reported to be very sick with an undisclosed illness, leading many to believe that he was HIV positive.
So now we're going to get into the trial. So the police and prosecution spent the next 5 years building a case against him. The trial commenced in 2006, and the first of 83 witnesses for the prosecution appeared on May 29th. The Crown relied heavily on the evidence of the written confessions, one from the day after he was arrested and the other taken 12 days later in front of the magistrate.
The trial was plagued with delays. According to one report, there were 20 formal postponements between September 2004 and August 2009. It took almost 10 years from the time of Similane's arrest to the time the trial was finally concluded. By 2010, both senior investigators had died.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Wow. What a lengthy trial process. We thought the OJ trial was long. Oh my God. So the prosecution rested in January of 2011. Similane's defense attorney boycotted the trial, accusing the judge of bias, and Similane was assigned a new lawyer who was nicknamed Totsi, a South African term for a gangster. After just 1 week of familiarizing himself with the entire trial, Totsi presented his case, calling just one witness, David Similane.
Totsi decided that 29 of the 34 counts had not even been proven by the prosecution, so he just decided to ignore them completely.
There's a strategy.
Okay. Yeah, all right. The remaining five victims, including the three Dlamini sisters, had all last been seen with Similane or a man thought to be Similane.
On the stand, Similane admitted he had known each of them, but said before they went missing, he had just taken them to an employment agent, Sipo Dlamini, a name that had never been brought up before in the previous 10 years. What? In Swaziland, the name Sipo Dlamini is very common, similar to how John Smith is in America. Okay. All right, buddy.
Okay.
Look at this guy over here. Look at him. Oh, my God.
Similane's testimony and cross-examination took 2 days. He showed no remorse and pleaded innocent, claiming the confessions had been coerced through torture. But on March 23, 2011, Similane was found guilty of murder on 28 of the 34 counts and sentenced to death by hanging.
After an appeal to the Swazi Supreme Court in November 2011, it was decided that the trial took an inadmissibly long time. But the death sentence was confirmed.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande, the host of True Crime Psychology and Personality. On my podcast, I explore and explain the pathology behind some of the most horrendous crimes and those who commit them. We discuss topics like narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, and antisocial personality disorder from a scientifically informed perspective. What is a narcissist? How do you spot a sociopath? What signs can you look for to protect yourself from these dangerous personalities? It's not just about the stories, but also the science and psychology behind them. So if you're interested in true crime or mental health, I'd encourage you to give my show a listen wherever you get podcasts.
So now we're going to get into where are they now? Tell us, Beth.
Similane became a born-again Christian, and he preaches to fellow inmates. His family has never visited him in jail and have said that the death penalty serves him right. Wow.
Okay.
But even before the end of the trial, they said that they would not welcome him back home, even if he was found not guilty. And even the authorities in the area said that Similane was not welcome to come back to the area.
Can you blame him?
No.
So his aunt, Alexina Similane, said that she did not feel pity for him. And if Similane eventually faces the noose, her last words to him would be, quote, "You must rest in peace, David. We will meet you in the other world. If you are a Christian, we will meet in heaven. But if you are not, you will go to hell," unquote. Wow, auntie. Okay, bars.
When asked why she had no pity on Similane, despite that he was reportedly a born-again Christian, Alexina likened the serial killer to a cannibal. Quote, "If a cannibal lives on human flesh, it will always kill to eat," unquote.
Wow.
I think she ain't wrong.
I don't think this is the auntie I need to get in touch with right now so she can basically map out the rest of my life, tell me all the right choices to make moving forward. That's what aunties are for.
Yeah.
And we need more aunties like Alexina in the world. So many people in Eswatini still believe that Semelani couldn't have done this on his own and someone was getting away with murder. Samantha's sister, Charmaine Kgazi Munro, said, quote, "The people he killed didn't have much money. These were people looking for jobs. We never heard of him housebreaking. So where was he getting his money from?" Unquote.
Don't know.
Yeah. Where is the money? What? Conspiracy theorists. 1, 2, 3, go. Let's go.
Samantha's mother, Mabel, added, quote, "He brought them to some syndicate, to some people to do the job. He was bringing them, getting paid and throwing them away," unquote.
Ooh, this one has some profound quotes in this episode.
Yeah.
Wow. Vusi Dlamani, a police officer whose wife Cindy was murdered, remembered thinking that when Cindy left, she was going to be meeting with more than one person. He also thought that they were going by car. So he believes that Semelani was just a middleman.
As far as we can tell, Simulani's execution has yet to be carried out. The last official executions in Swaziland took place in 1983. And these were convictions for ritual murder, by the way. And King Mswati III has not allowed a hanging since his coronation in 1986. So I guess, you know, he's all right for that.
There's that. So when you weigh the pros and the cons, yeah.
Still bad. So
now we're going to get into what we think made Semelani snap in our takeaways. What do you got, Beth?
So although I think it's possible that Semelani was killing these people for body parts and working with other people, I think it's more probable that he was just a run-of-the-mill serial killer.
You're not that special, Semelani.
Yeah, not that special. And, but I don't buy his motive. I mean,
thank you. Talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. He was probably pissed that he went to jail for rape.
Yeah.
And maybe he didn't do that one. But it sounds like he had raped women.
Yeah, it did. Yeah. I mean, he had been arrested for
it. Yes. It's on his record. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in these murders, there was definitely a sexual motivation, which there wouldn't be if you're just killing people for
body parts.
Right.
Sure.
And
yeah.
When they were found, when the victims were found, they were tied up and some showed signs of having been sexually assaulted. So I think for sure there was a sexual motivation.
Yeah.
And he was probably angry with women in general for some reason. Shitty childhood, whatever, you know.
Maybe.
Serial killers.
Yeah.
I think he just used his quote unquote wrongful conviction as an excuse, you know.
I do too. But I actually think it's a really poor excuse because it was women in his family who showed him kindness when he had nowhere else to go.
Yeah, I know. This happens, though, with men sometimes because the women in their lives are the ones that are there that show up and everything.
Yeah.
Then they're the ones that get all the anger. It's not fair, but it
doesn't make any sense.
Doesn't make any sense. No, but our psyches don't always make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah. Isn't it weird how human brains and minds work?
Stupid brains.
Oh my God. But yeah, that is interesting that when you look at his past, but they were there for you.
I know.
They even said after you were convicted, we'll see you in heaven if you are a Christian.
Yeah.
But if you're not, we'll see you in hell.
See you in hell.
To which I say, have you been around in 2022? We already are in hell.
We're here.
Yeah. Anyway, when I was researching this case, apparently there were two serial killers active in Eswatini at this time.
I saw that somewhere, but I couldn't. There's no other Eswatini serial killer that I know of.
Well,
I think maybe there was maybe one in South Africa, but I couldn't find who it was. But I saw that was mentioned in one article, and I tried to look for information about it, but I couldn't find anything.
Well, see, that's the difference between you and me, because I saw it and I just went with it.
Well, there were.
It was on the internet, and
it now
has
I
to
believe
be
it.
A fact. Also, I love conspiracy theories.
I know.
This case is just so perfect for all of it.
Yeah.
So conspiracy theorists, I mean, this, I just love that. I love an opportunity to get those conspiracy theory formulas going. Yeah. Also reflecting on the context. So the employment was super low and men were leaving the country to go work at the mines in South Africa to be next to Elon Musk.
Yeah.
And that left women in the society in a really vulnerable position. And so part of me thinks we shouldn't be surprised at how great the number was.
Yeah.
When you consider how vulnerable and in need
and desperate
these people were to support their families.
Right.
Yes. And so it just opened them up to be susceptible and their safety was compromised because of the lack was in their existence.
Resources.
So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And then I watched the video of him talking. It's in the sources. And it's really creepy how relaxed he is, even though it's not in English. I read the subtitles, but if you're just watching his body language, everybody else in the room is emotional. Why did you do this? You weren't working alone. How dare you kill all these women? I mean, they were just throwing the book at him.
Right.
You know what? I did it.
Yeah.
It was me. And it was just really, chilling. Yeah.
Weird.
And odd. Oh, they kept like pleading with him in the video, like, just tell the truth, be honest. And he was like, I already told you the truth.
I already am being honest. Yeah, I did it.
Yeah. And they seem to not want to let go the idea of him doing it on his own, which again, at the time, if we're looking at context, the nation was really suffering from this AIDS epidemic.
Right.
And I also was under the impression, kind of like we have here with law enforcement, is that when something really bad is happening in the setting of other really bad things happening, like police are just like, we got to solve this crime. We got to close this now. And so part of me thought of Similani as kind of like a boogeyman. So even if he didn't do all the 45 murders, it was a relief to close this case,
right,
for closure for the families of the victims, but also for the community.
Right.
And the problem of poverty. The poverty is, I think, a really important aspect of this case because of how desperate these women were. Some of them were even turning to sex work at the time. Desperation contributes to vulnerable women engaging in sex work the sex profession. Contributes to intimate partner violence. This desperation, this poverty is just a big problem.
Yeah.
And so I think that connection has to be pointed out when talking about these murders.
Right.
That's all I got. Well, so now I guess it's
a really good job. Up on that one.
We did.
You did.
Internet high five. So thank you, my friend. I love it when you say nice things to me. Okay, but don't do it anymore. Stop.
Okay.
Now it's time to talk about how not to get murdered. So if you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you. I'll never forget when I first pitched that song to you when we were at lunch.
What an idea.
And you were like, yes. Oh my God. We were in a restaurant. The restaurant went quiet. So here we are today.
Yep, here we are. This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's experiences.
Well, I think that this is a good episode to reflect on the fact that crime can be a symptom of other problems society, mostly because of lack of resources, lack of education, lack of food, lack of housing. So my recommendation to prevent people from getting murdered is to how can we help? So find a mutual aid organization in your area that you can donate to, not just money, but you can volunteer your time. And what these mutual aid organizations do is help reduce ignorance and lack of awareness around these problems. So mutual aid groups in your area are dialed into the issues plaguing your specific community. And they're already doing the work. They just need help. So even if you can't give your time or money, checking them out on social media, there's a website, mutualaidhub.org. See what's in your area and just follow them, learn about the issues that they are fighting to fix and that they're already working on. And you can elevate those issues by telling your friends about them, sharing their posts, and supporting them in any way that you can. So that's very my recommendation cool. to help with the poverty problem.
Yeah.
Wendy, I was just imagining myself on the Miss America stage. I want to end poverty, world poverty. Now, give me my crown. So now it's shout out time, where we shout out any content by or about any marginalized or othered folks or any true crime goodies.
Okay.
And I just wanted to shout out the movie Prey on Hulu. Have you seen?
I have not watched it because it's not really in my wheelhouse, but
okay.
It looks really exciting.
It is really exciting. And it is 92% on Rotten Tomatoes. And it's about a warrior who is a girl warrior, a female warrior. And she could be Two-Spirit, but I didn't get that from the movie. Anyway, it's really, really exciting. And it's just really awesome to see an indigenous woman kicking ass.
Yeah, isn't
it? Underestimated at every turn.
Part of the Predator series.
Is it? I don't know.
That was my understanding, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. That's why I didn't watch it. I was like, because that kind of movie just stresses me out.
Oh my God. I love it. Okay. I won't take you to go see the premiere of Predator with me, but no. I don't. But now that I'm thinking about the monster in the movie, it is kind of Predator-esque. Hmm. But anyway, it's just cool to see indigenous people kicking ass.
Oh, for sure. Very cool. Screen.
So what do you got?
I got a true crime goodie. It's called Blackbird and it's on Apple TV Plus.
Is it about the Beatles?
No.
Did they do something?
No.
Oh, okay.
It's based on a true story about a guy who gets sent to prison on a drug charge. And then he's asked to try and get a confession from a serial killer. So he's in jail with this serial killer and he has to try to like make friends with him and get information out of him. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds really rad. Yeah. Okay.
It's good.
Awesome.
And then I also wanted to say that Reservation Dogs is back with season 2 on Hulu.
Pew, 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 pew.
Yeah.
So it's out now?
It's out. Yeah. I already watched a couple of episodes. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So the shout outs are Prey movie on Hulu, Blackbird on Apple TV Plus, and Reservation Dogs is back, y'all, also on Hulu. Boy, oh boy, I really loved this episode.
Yeah,
this was a really interesting case to dive into.
It was.
But that's it for today. In the meantime, Beth, where can the people find us?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all of our social media. Join our discussion group on Facebook at Fruit Loops Pod Discussion. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App. Just Google Fruit Loops Pod Cash App, or you can become a monthly patron through Patreon. And as always, we have merch for sale on our website.
So this is a weekly podcast, and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, y'all. It's crazy out there.
Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.